You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. It is 8:30, and we have with us in the studios, once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. How are you both this morning?
Good.
That is a loaded question.
We'll
just say good and leave it at that.
Okay,
let's
just leave it at that superficial level.
Yes, exactly. It's one of those questions where you don't really want
the
true answer.
Yeah.
No, we don't. And we don't have time for it, actually.
That's true, too.
It's just
another one of those weeks.
Another one. And not a particularly good one for Mr. Trent Lott.
No. It seems like his sentiments caught up with him, these little hints of bigotry that have been leaking out here and there like errant bodily fluids over the past 20 years or so have finally hit the mainstream media, and more importantly become a political scandal because it hit the mainstream media at a time when a lot of Lott's political enemies, both especially within the Republican Party, saw a vulnerability and saw the usefulness of a change in political leadership for the Republicans. So, I mean, not all of this by a long stretch had to do with people being shocked, utterly shocked, that a 61-year-old white male senator from the state of Mississippi could utter such sentiments, especially when he's done so any number of times in the past, and in fact has said exactly the same thing about Strom Thurmond's candidacy in 48 at least once before. But
and he's not alone.
And he's not alone. I mean, it's very interesting to remember, because certainly no enterprising network reporter has been talking about it, the last few days, that John Ashcroft got in quite a bit of trouble up before and leading to his confirmation hearings in January 2001 for having many of the same sort of dubious friends and questionable remarks in his past. Everything from blocking the nomination of Ronnie White, the first African-American Supreme Court justice for the state of Missouri, to a federal judgeship. There was an appointment to the head of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, which of course Ashcroft wound up leading, that he also blocked. And there was this notorious interview that he gave to Southern Partisan Magazine, which is this neo-Confederacy magazine of the same types of questionable associations and fondness for the old days when the darkies knew their place, that Trent Lott had gotten himself into a little bit of trouble in the past with through his through the speeches that he gave and the awards that he took from the Council of Concerned Bigots, or whatever the name of the group down there is. But Ashcroft gets into trouble for this. There are any number of questionable racial associations in the Republican closet, and that really hasn't been the direction that the media coverage has gone. It is focused very tightly on Trent Lott, very tightly on this one issue. And again, he's out the door now, and you have in his place probably Senator Bill Frist from Tennessee, who is the only person actually to declare his open candidacy for Trent Lott's seat before Lott stepped down.
Well, I think Nichols was had
yeah,
it in
Nichols,
mind too.
Nichols has talked about it. Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, who is the husband actually of Elaine Chao, the Department of Labor appointee in the Bush cabinet, and Frist also is very close to the White House. But you look at Frist and McConnell, both are pretty much people who have attained office in states that were traditionally Democratic, that benefited and really based their careers on the same sort of wink wink nudge nudge Southern strategy that got Trent Lott into office and helped the Republican Party take really control of many of the elected offices in this throughout the South throughout the 70s and 80s and 90s. So to say that the Republican Party is going through a soul searching on issues of race is not especially accurate, especially when you look at what they say versus what they do. Now, almost all of the attention in the past week has been on what Trent Lott says, and a little bit from his critics has been on, well, this is consistent with his voting record. Well, his original sentiments, as opposed to his apologies, were very consistent with his voting record. In fact, when he went on BET talking about you know, how Strom, how he really regretted his votes on MLK Day and affirmative action. And, you know, there's this long list of votes that he really regretted now, right? And the irony of this, of course, was that Strom Thurmond was one of the few Southern Republicans who really had seemingly kind of recalibrated himself to the new age, a new day, and had actually voted for some of these things. But at the same time, while his voting record is in place, the Republican Party and the Bush administration are still very actively doing things that are racially questionable. We had a number of cases of that just this very week that could have been very usefully tied in the media coverage and were not. One of the most interesting to me was the overturning of the Central Park Wilding verdict from 1989. For folks who are maybe over the age of 30, and especially if you live on the East Coast, you can remember this was a huge media deal where five black teenagers were accused and convicted of attacking and raping and killing a young female white investment banker in Central Park in New York City. And this became sort of the springing board. Well, the very term wilding entered the English language for a while, pretty much as a result of this case. But it also became a springboard for all this talk about, you know, super predators and urban youth out of control, and of course urban being that code word for black
for
and
black.
Latino, mm-hmm. especially black. And here we are 13 years later, and lo and behold, you had a convicted rapist murderer named Keyes who showed up in January saying, you know, I actually did this, and lo and behold, DNA testing confirmed that he, in fact, was at least involved in the rape of this woman before her death. And on Thursday, the convictions of these five no longer teenagers, they're now all in their late 20s or early 30s, were thrown out and they were released. And it looks unlikely that they will be retried or recharged. But you still have Republican New York Police Department Commissioner Michael Kelly going on the record and saying, you know, I don't agree with it. This is a state Supreme Court justice for the state of New York who made this ruling. He was totally out of line. And I still think these folks are guilty. You know, maybe they just helped out, but they were definitely there. Even though in the original convictions, all it was based on was confessions. The physical evidence didn't match. The physical evidence actually made it look like there was only one or two people there, not like there were several dozen. It was a very muddy site, and there were virtually no footprints. It's mind-boggling that, you know, the presumption for certain classes of people is that they're guilty until proven innocent, and that mindset maintains. You know, we had the governor of Illinois pardoning another three people who were on death row and who were exonerated by DNA evidence. There are probably inmates in prisons all over the country that could be released by a simple DNA test if the funding were there. If the Republican Party were serious about race issues, one of the many things that it could do would be to provide the funding or to advocate for providing the funding. But it's not happening.
And then we understand this week, to compensate for all the people they're letting out of jail, Los Angeles is kicking
exactly.
in.
Exactly.
And throwing in by the thousands.
Yeah. Hundreds anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. Somewhere between 500 to 1,000 Middle Eastern immigrant men were arrested in Los Angeles, Orange County, and San Diego this week when they went to the INS to register under the revamped exit entry program. Men over the age of 16 were required to register by Monday if they were from five countries, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Sudan, and Libya. Many of them took their lawyers with them because they knew that their visas had expired, but they had applied for green cards, and they wanted to prove that they were part of the legal immigration process, that they had been waiting for the glacial pace of the INS to approve their green card applications and to schedule hearings for them. Some of them actually had hearings scheduled, but these men were arrested anyway. And the interesting thing about it is you have to think back to September 11th and remember that the hijackers were from Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Lebanon. They were not from Iran, Iraq, Syria, Sudan. They were not from these countries.
Yeah, we've totally shifted our focus
and
of attention.
And you have to remember that the September 11th hijackers had their green cards, or they had visas. They were legally in the United States. They were not people who had allowed their visas to expire. And so this sweeping up these people who are part of the immigration process, who were put in jail even though they were not particularly at fault for their visas having expired and their green cards not having been approved yet, because the INS is not a very efficient organization and had not been working on their cases in a timely manner.
And it's especially not timely for citizens from Middle Eastern countries, because they're reviewing those particularly closely at this point, it seems.
Yeah, and many of these people also are married to U.S. citizens. They have parents who are naturalized citizens or are U.S. citizens. And these are not the guys who are going to be committing terrorist acts. Most of them do not have criminal records. However, the detainees were treated very, very badly. I mean, they were put in cells where they couldn't lay down. They could only sleep on a concrete floor. Some of them were sprayed with cold water before they were put into the cells. I think that was probably a crowd control tactic. And the ironic thing is most of the detainees in Southern California are Iranian, and many of them are Iranian Jews who had emigrated from Iran to escape the fundamentalist government and repression there. So, and there were also reports that people were detained in places like Cleveland, Dallas, and Minnesota, where there are large Middle Eastern immigrant populations. And you look at this and you have to say, look, this is not based on security concerns. It is a racist policy. And it's not a racist policy of Trent Lott. It is a racist policy of the Bush administration, a Republican administration. And when the media focuses on something that one Republican senator said, but they ignore something that is a racist policy of the current administration, you know that there is something wrong.
Yeah, and look at who the INS is run by. The INS falls under the Department of Justice, which is
directly
John Ashcraft.
Under John Ashcraft.
Yeah, directly under him. And now the other interesting thing about this is you can be sure that word of this is traveling very quickly through community centers, through email, through phone calls, etc., amongst various immigrant populations. There are 13 more countries that are due for which citizens are due to have these registrations in the next couple of weeks. You can be sure that there are going to be a lot of people who are going to be very, very reluctant to show up, because you know they figure they'd rather take their chances on getting arrested later than for sure being arrested now. And that really is the mindset that a lot of non-citizens in this country have right now, is that it is a police state, that I can be picked up at any time for any reason. You know, I wind up in a jail under conditions that really aren't a whole lot different than they are in my notoriously abusive home country.
And I lose my job,
and I'm separated from my family, which is often an American family.
There's this
myth that if you have an American citizen spouse, you automatically become a citizen, and that's not at all true.
Not true.
The INS has to schedule the hearing for that, and right now they're not scheduling those kind of hearings. Thank you very much.
Or they're scheduling them so far out that your visa expires and then you become one of the people who is subject to arrest.
Yeah, so you know, an awful lot of people are going to come to the rational decision that, you know, they would rather not register at all. And so I can almost guarantee you that about the end of January, we're going to get these alarming media reports of all these people who have decided to stay in the United States illegally
but
and how they
registered.
Have to be they're not registered and they have to be rounded up and yada, yada, yada. It is very, very racist, and it also has virtually nothing to do with security, with making Americans safe from terrorist acts. What it does do is convince an unfortunately large number of people in this country that something is being done. And the way you convince people that something is being done is that they're targeting all of those brown-skinned people.
And that's racist.
And that's very racist.
I understand there was so many arrests in Los Angeles that they literally ran out of the plastic handcuffs.
Yeah, and they ran out of jail space, too. They had to send them off to – they were talking about sending them off to Arizona.
Yeah, so they just put them in little lock boxes for a while. That was no
shipping
problem.
Shipping containers like they do in Afghanistan.
They should have contacted SPD for those plastic handcuffs, because I always see that they have plenty on
hand. They stock up on a regular basis.
Yeah, so, and, you know, the other piece of this also is we don't know yet that this is not a local story as well.
We don't.
And there are a number of groups locally doing very, very good work right now around immigrant rights. The Hate-Free Zone in particular is keeping very close track, as is the Washington Alliance for Immigrant Refugee Justice. Folks should get involved with those groups. If you're looking at end-of-year donations, they would be a very, very good groups to support, because they are stretched way, way thin right now. And they need all the help and all the support and all the volunteer energy they can get.
All right, well, moving along, you didn't hear it in the U.S. media, but it actually, a German newspaper broke the listing of the U.S. corporations that have been doing business with Iraq.
Yeah, no, I thought it was pretty funny, because at first it was reported as a group of about 10 U.S. companies that supplied nuclear, chemical, and biological components for the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction programs prior to the Gulf War. And then it turns out that it's more like about 24 companies and a number of government agencies. I'm just going to read a few of them. I can't read all of them. That would take a long time. But they include notorious U.S. defense contractors like Honeywell, Unisys, Tektronix, Rockwell, Hewlett-Packard, Eastman Kodak, DuPont, the American Type Culture Collection, which sent anthrax samples to Iraq. Includes Electronic Associates, International Computer Systems, our friend Bechtel, Canberra Industries, Inc., and among the government labs that sent cultures to Iraq, you've got Lawrence Livermore Laboratories, which actually sent nuclear weapons information to them. Los Alamos and Sandia were part of it as well. The CDC also helped to send some biocultures to Iraq. So in other words, you know, I mean, looking at the list, you get a really good feel for the fact that Iraq was a very close ally of ours for a very long time.
And to jump in on this, remember, if it seems unfair to trot out that all this happened before the Gulf War and before we knew that Saddam was an enemy and yada yada yada, remember that much of the evidence being marshaled for Iraq's weapons of mass destruction dates to prior to the Gulf War as well. Quite a bit that was in the Blair dossier, quite a bit that's been in the White House.
And we need to remember that during the 1980s, the Reagan administration knew that Saddam Hussein was using chemical weapons on the Kurds and on Iranian troops. They knew it. It was well known. It was reported in U.S. newspapers. U.S. companies could have and should have known of it as well.
And one of the persons in the Reagan administration that was best positioned to know about that was their Middle Eastern Envoy, Special Affairs, I forget exactly what the title was, but basically the U.S. person who handled foreign policy and arms sales for the Middle East, that person was Donald Rumsfeld.
And my understanding is that some of these companies continued to sell this equipment and the different things to Iraq after the 80s, during the 90s, after the Gulf War.
Yeah, so, that we don't have detailed records on. All we got leaked was the list.
Right, right. But
that information would be in the Iraq dossier that Iraq delivered to the UN into the U.S.'s hands.
and that the U.S. wanted to go through and edit it gave copies to any
and
other
I'm sure
Security Council
countries. Right, I'm sure part countries. Of what they edited out was that kind of information.
Yeah, they didn't put it into the U.S.'s hands. They gave it to the U.N., which then the U.S. came in and took it.
Right, right, right.
Exactly.
Right.
So, and what I also found intriguing was the fact that originally the five member nations of the UN Security Council said that the only thing that we're going to hold out of those 12,000 pages where we're going to pull the plans for making a nuclear weapon or, you know, making the actual weapons. And then mysteriously 2 weeks later, they decided, well, you know what? I think we're all in agreement here that we're going to pull the names of all the companies within our countries that did business there in
right.
Iraq. Isn't
can't
that interesting?
Let the public know that information.
You know, if you can't get rid of the bloody footprints or bloody handprints, sometimes you got to get rid of the whole tablecloth. The other thing that's interesting about this, just very briefly, is that when you raise names ones like Bechtel and Honeywell and, you know,
Rockwell and Unisys.
All these various companies that are DoD contractors as well. It really underscores how the arms trade really prospers by selling weapons to both sides, not just in this conflict, but in many, many conflicts around the world. And the United States government has promoted this also, where they go in and underwrite the credit, underwrite the promotion, give offset deals and so forth. Boeing has prospered quite a bit for this, for instance, between Greece and Turkey, and in some cases in shooting wars as well. It's like, let's you and he go kill each other. And, the U.S. is very definitely doing that in the war between Iraq and Iran as well.
And let's not forget also the sales to Iraq, that a lot of that was funded with money that came from a bank called BCCI, which one of its partners was a bank called BNL. And I can't fully pronounce
that. Tied in with the savings and loan.
Exactly. Yes. And who sat on the BNL board? None other than Henry Kissinger, and who was a client of Henry Kissinger and Associates as well. So perhaps just one of the reasons that Henry Kissinger decided to step down from the 911 commission. I don't know.
Well, you can do that, and don't forget and
for the next
endlessly, because
6 hours.
We are a country that is a global empire that has prospered off of other people's misery for a very long time, and that's really what all this adds up to.
All right, there was some other news related to Iraq this week as well.
Yeah, the Iraq dossier, the Bushies and the Blairites stood up and said, well, it doesn't contain all the information that it needs to. It's a material breach. You have to really look at the information that they're talking about. The omissions that they're talking about are really things that were brought up by the Butler inspection team in the last year of the inspections, when it was clear that Iraq had destroyed like 99% of their weapons of mass destruction capability, that the inspectors had been responsible for that, and that the issue came up of, well, do we lift the sanctions? You know, we haven't accomplished our motive here of overthrowing Saddam Hussein. Do we lift the sanctions, or do we keep pressing on that last 1% of weapons that they haven't been able to completely verify that they've been destroyed? You know, do we keep pushing on that forever in order to keep the sanctions in place? That was pretty much the function of Richard Butler's team in 1998, the last year of the inspections. And that's what the U.S. decided to do, and what the inspection teams decided to do under Butler, who is a U.S. citizen. And that's pretty much what the folks in the Bush administration and in the Blair administration in the UK mean when they say that there are serious omissions from the report. They're talking about that last 1% of chemical and biological agents and precursor chemicals and equipment that might have gone into, that have dual use purpose, that might have gone into a nuclear or a chemical weapons program. They're talking about that last little 1%. And it's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, and one of the things that's to the tremendous advantage of the propagandists in the Blair and Bush administration is it's virtually impossible to prove a negative.
It's hard to prove that you destroyed something. Iraq destroyed a lot of their biological weapons capability, and then to cover their butts, they destroyed a lot of the paperwork showing who authorized the programs in the first place and who authorized the destruction of them, to try to kind of cover their butts, hoping the inspectors wouldn't find that they'd had a bioweapons program, so that when they did discover that Iraq had a small bioweapons program and there wasn't any paperwork there, it was a way for the inspectors to point and say, you didn't destroy them, they're hiding somewhere. You know, like you can take a whole bioweapons lab and put it on the back of a pickup truck and hide it. You can't.
Or on the back of a camel or whatever.
Right, I mean, or whatever. You know, but you can't prove a negative. You can't prove that those weren't actually destroyed when all of the documentation has been destroyed too.
But to use that as a pretext for war, I mean,
it's ridiculous.
You know, it's ridiculous. You're talking about using war as a first resort rather than using war as a last resort. And they're, you know, it's eminently, extremely apparent that this administration is looking for a pretext by which it can justify to the world and to its own citizens going in and invading Iraq and evincing regime change.
Yeah, and they've even set the timetable now, saying that it's going to be late January or early February to coincide with the first real report report by the International Atomic Energy Administration to the Security Council.
And, you know, one of those the companies that did business with Iraq over the last 10 years as well that actually wasn't mentioned on this list was Vice President Dick Cheney's former...
Halliburton.
Yeah. How did they escape?
There's no mission.
If people want to hear more,
I think
on
Germany
that,
should invade. Yeah.
If people want to hear more on that, we're actually going to tomorrow morning at about 7:40. We are going to carry the Democracy Now! Segment where that first broke with the U.S. list of names here in the U.S. media. So people need to tune in for that. They should tune in for everything tomorrow, but especially that. So you're almost out of time. Afghanistan, which is related to all this.
There was, yeah, a lot of people are saying, look, you can't go into Iraq until you clean up the problems in Afghanistan. Many Americans think that Afghanistan is over, finished, everything's nice and fine there. Human Rights Watch dispelled some of that myth this week when they released a report on the status of women in Afghanistan. It's entitled "We Want to Live as Humans." In fact, they have documented that women in Afghanistan do not live as human beings. They still live under the burqa, have restricted movement. A lot of women cannot go out of the house without a male relative accompanying them. They still have to be completely covered. It's particularly bad in Western Afghanistan, where women live exactly as they did under the Taliban, with not much more freedom at all. If a woman, for example, gets into a taxi cab with a male cab driver, she then is subject to arrest, being taken to the hospital and being examined to see if she's engaged in sexual activity, a forced examination. I mean, this is the same as what would have happened under the Taliban. There is a new ministry in the Afghan government that was set up earlier this year. It's similar to the religious police under the Taliban. It employs men and women who walk around, this is including in the city of Kabul, who walk around and yell and scream at women who are not covering their hair, who are wearing makeup, who are walking around in the company of men that they are not related to, or who are trying to buy their groceries alone. I mean, it is just insane. And it has not been covered here that there have been girls' schools in Afghanistan that have been burned and bombed. So there has been serious intimidation over the education of girls in Afghanistan. It's a serious problem. We went to war there supposedly to try to fix this problem, and no progress has been made. And so I suggest that people go to the Human Rights Watch website and look at this report. That's at www.hrw.org, HRW for Human Rights Watch.
And they have very good reports also in a number of other countries like Uzbekistan that have become our close allies since 9/11 and that are similarly egregious. The interesting thing to me is that most Americans have this perception after the Taliban fled and the troops came into Kabul, and you know they have this image of people sort of suddenly playing music and dancing in the streets and welcoming the liberators. And
that's how it was reported.
You could
have read it in the New York Times, right?
Yeah, and that is how people have the perception of the response will be in Baghdad as well. And yet people in the Middle East, although not here, know, even if they weren't otherwise skeptical, that this has been the fate of the Afghan people. The thing really haven't gotten any better for those people. They certainly haven't been transformed in any kind of a functioning democracy with anything approaching human rights. And this information has been freely available to the American media. I mean, you know, you could set up a TV camera in the middle of the Kabul square and you would capture much of this. You don't even have to go out into the countryside, but you know
it's worse out in the countryside.
It is, and you know, out in the countryside is really a very different world from the capital city, as it is in many third world countries. But particularly in this one, because the warlords, rather than the Karzai administration, control almost all the countryside. But you know, even now, we aren't getting that information.
All right. Well, with that, we are pretty much out of time once again.
I'd like to urge folks, too, to the Youth Undoing Racism group has been doing a 24-hour vigil down in Westlake Park started about 1 o'clock yesterday. It's a vigil against war and against the racist policies of the Bush administration, topic of our show today. I'd urge people to take some used clothes and donate them down there. Visit the young people who have been doing their 24-hour vigil in Westlake Mall. Just go down and take a look and see them.
Yeah. And you
today.
Know, right now,
their vigil ends at 1 o'clock.
Yeah, it's pretty chilly outside. They're warming up. They're just getting up. Go help them out. Say hi. You know, give them some donations, and that'd be great.
Blankets, too.
Yeah, like that. And congratulations on them for taking this on. It's wonderful.
That's right. All right. With that, we are out of time, talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And tell us, where do we find Eat the State?
Well, it is the year-end issue that is out in places where you get free publications, bookstores, cafes, bars, wherever else we might be hanging out. That comes out every other week. It's a free newspaper that a bunch of volunteers put out. It covers global as well as local affairs. And you can also find it on the web, www.eatthestate, all one word, .org, or you can subscribe, $24 for 1 year, $45 for two. Year-end donations, very welcome, very actually necessary, at P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. If you missed any of that, or if you want to volunteer or donate or have comments or feedback or story tips, give us a call. The number is 206-903-9461.